Wednesday, March 22nd, 2023. You are listening to the Daily Dose Sports Podcast, and I am your host, Clint Daly, coming to you from Mile High City here in Denver, Colorado. And we are back for another week of talking sports with a dose of common sense. Hey, happy Wednesday to you. I hope your week is going well. Hope you, your family, your friends, everyone is staying strong and staying healthy right now. And more importantly, I hope that you have been enjoying March Madness and all the fun that comes with it. You know, I have a little bit of an interesting story to share with you today. You know, my wife was recently talking to a friend of hers, and this friend used to actually work for a urologist. And as fascinating as all those stories are, she was telling Mrs. Dose an alarming stat. And, of course, Mrs. Dose shared that with me. And I had to look into it for myself, but this is absolutely true. Do you realize that in the last several years, urologists across the country are reporting major increases, like as much as 50% increases, in the number of vasectomies scheduled in the days leading up to March Madness?
What?
I'm not even kidding. You can look it up yourself. With just a little bit of clever scheduling, it seems that many men have found a loophole that turns, let's say, one of life's more unpleasant procedures into a four-day little vacation that coincides perfectly with March Madness. Now, most men, let's be honest, are going to run in the opposite direction at the mere mention of the words scalpel and scrotum in the same sentence. I understand, but it seems that urologists have been kind of co-opting the lure of the NCAA tournament to get patients in the door, on the table, and back home in recovery just in time to watch four straight days of college hoops. Now, I don't know about this. For the record, they say the second leading time to get vasectomies is actually in early April for the Masters in the PGA. But hey, a lot of men are doing it. What I have to kind of ask is it worth it just to stay home and watch college basketball for four straight days? I don't know. It might be. I know this. When you go to, say, the dentist, it isn't the procedure that you're having done that causes all the pain. It's that gigantic needle in your tender regions that kind of get the party started. That's the worst of it. Once you get through that, then I would think it's all kind of downhill from there. This has to be the same sort of principle, doesn't it? Get through it, and then I guess you'll be fine, right? Here is my one word of caution for those gentlemen out there who are considering that March Madness vasectomy. Many, many men, families, are thinking to themselves, hey, I need a vasectomy because I don't want kids. Here is my word of caution to you. When you go through the pain, when you go through the trauma, to what is a very highly sensitive area, just keep in mind when you go home, your kids are still going to be there. So sit back, relax, enjoy the college basketball and the ice cream. Just remember, the ice cream isn't actually for you to eat.
Take very short breaths.
Hey, before we jump in today, just want to remind you, be sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com where we have new articles going up every week. I know I've taken a little break from articles recently, but never fear. I'll be getting back to articles very, very soon. But we have links to the podcast over there. We have links to the video over there. We have links to the Daily Dose gear. If you need a t-shirt, you need a sweatshirt, you need a hoodie, maybe a coffee mug, make sure you're stopping by DailyDoseSports.com every single week because we do have new things going up over there. Also, before we get started today, we do it every single year, but make sure you go over to ESPN and join the ESPN Men's Tournament Challenge. I know the tournament is already underway, But I posted a link at dailydosports.com. You can still sign up. It is free to join. Just join the group called Daily Dose. It's going to ask you if you want to join a group. You say yes. You go in and you search for Daily Dose, D-A-L-Y-D-O-S-E, no spaces, one word. You get points for your correct picks. And if you win the challenge, we will be sending you a Daily Dose t-shirt. You do get to pick the color that you want. Entering is free, and even though the tournament is underway, you can still go over and join. And hey, if your picks are good enough, remember, it's not how you pick early. It is the person that gets the picks right late that wins these bracket challenges. Never, ever forget that. But you can go over and sign up anytime. Hey, go win that Daily Dose t-shirt. Bragging rights are on the line. Hey, today on the show, I actually have a little business to attend to this week. But never fear, because as March Madness is rolling along right now, and we are all glued to these games, what better time is there to break out some March Madness flavored Daily Dose top fives from the past? Today, we are flashing back to the early days of the Daily Dose when we were counting down the top five unlikely Final Four teams, the top five last back-to-back NCAA champions, the top five NCAA champions that actually had a number of losses, the top five scoring performances in a tournament, the top five scoring freshmen, and the top five saddest moments in March Madness history. Hey, just a little heads up, any clips that we do play today, they're not ours. They are the property of CBS Sports. We are simply using them to give you the feeling of being right there. So sit back, relax, and enjoy a flashback episode of the Daily Dose Sports Podcast. As we do every single week, we've got to get to our Daily Dose top five. You know, with Syracuse being the number 10 seed and getting to the Final Four, I started thinking about the five most unlikely teams to ever make it to the Final Four. Because, you know, Syracuse, and we talked about this when we did our Daily Dose preview for the tournament. There's always a team, it seems like, that we say they don't look like they even belong in it. Like they shouldn't even got in the tournament. Not only do they get in to win a game, they get in to win a game and go on a run, and sometimes they make it even as far as Syracuse has done, making it to the Final Four. Let's look back at five times this has happened. Our first one, the number six seed in the 1987 NCAA tournament. You know, when Rick Pitino took over at Providence, he inherited a bunch of, you know, sloppy, out-of-shape kids that were mostly a bunch of nerds. His point guard was kind of fat, and they say smoked way too much. But, you know, a year later, they got to the NIT in his first year. A year later, somehow Rick Pitino had transformed that team, and his point guard, who smoked too much and was kind of fat, Billy Donovan, was putting up 21 points a game. When you think back to this Providence run, during the tournament, they beat Alabama. That was that Derek McKee group, very, very athletic Bama team. They beat Georgetown, that Reggie Williams, Charles Smith team, very, very good Georgetown team. They ended up getting all the way to the Final Four. They lost to Sherman Douglas, Derek Coleman, and Syracuse. But that was an amazing run that the Providence Friars went on in 1987. Our number four entry, and when I say this one, you're going to say, what are you talking about? Unlikely. They were likely. They were one of the favorites that year. They were number six seed. 1983, North Carolina State. It wasn't that North Carolina State wasn't capable. They were very capable, but I want you to think about this. The Wolfpack trailed in seven of their last nine games. They had to win the ACC tournament to even get into the tournament. During the season, they lost to unranked Wake Forest by 18. And in the opening round of the tournament, they were down six to Pepperdine with 24 seconds left in the game. They somehow found a way to come back, win it in overtime. Then they beat UNLV with Sidney Green. They beat Utah. They beat Ralph Sampson's Virginia team. They beat Georgia. And in the championship, they beat Hakeem Olajuwon and the Houston Cougars to win the national championship. But, you know, North Carolina State, to start the tournament, you look at them and say, they're never going to the Final Four. They're not even going to get out of first game. Somehow made it all the way and won the whole thing. Number three on our list. Wasn't that long ago. Think back to 2013 and Wichita State. The Shockers were a number nine seed. They had lost three of their final five games, but Cleanthony Early, Ron Baker, Fred VanVleet got hot at the right time. They crushed Pitt in the opening game.
And they had to face number one Gonzaga, who was the overall number one seed that year. Eked out a victory, got a win by six. They beat LaSalle, who somehow had snuck through. They beat number two Ohio State. And then they ended up getting all the way to the Final Four, where they lost to Louisville. And that was that Peyton Siva, Montrezl Harrell squad. Louisville ended up winning the entire thing that year. But what an amazing run by Wichita State. Move on to number two, most unlikely teams to go to the Final Four. We look at 2011, Virginia Commonwealth. I mean, they were in that large bid. And in fact, Virginia Commonwealth that year, VCU had to play in the play-in game versus USC. But Shaka Smart had that team playing well. They were pressing. They were trapping. They were giving every single team that they played a fit. And again, they got hot at the right time. They crushed USC in that opening game. Then they beat Georgetown. Then they beat Purdue. Barely slipped past Florida State. And then they had to play the number one seed, Kansas. And he said, well, that was a fun ride. But they beat Kansas too. Made it to the Final Four. If you remember, on Selection Sunday, when they did the committee selection show, Jay Bielas said, not only does VCU fail the eye test, they fail the laugh test. VCU kind of had the last laugh on that one. They went all the way to the Final Four. Our number one team, most unlikely team to make it to the Final Four, who else could it be? It's got to be 2006 George Mason. Jim Larrañaga's team gets hot, but it wasn't just that they made it. It was who they beat to make it to the Final Four. George Mason just kind of got a funky schedule, how it all worked out. And they had lost their best player. Tony Skin had been suspended for getting in a fight in a previous game during their tournament game of their conference. He's out. And now when you look at the tournament, they were sitting there at the number 9 seed. They had to play Michigan State right off the bat. Or no, they were number 10 seed, sorry. They had to play Michigan State. Michigan State had Shannon Brown. They had Maurice Alger, loaded team. They won by 10. They had to play North Carolina with Tyler Hansbrough and that loaded team. They won by 5. They had to play Wichita State, and then they had to play the number one overall seed, UConn Huskies. Rudy Gay, Josh Boone, that team was loaded. They were supposed to win the whole thing. George Mason slipped past them too. 86-84, they had to hold on for dear life, but George Mason got there. They ended up losing to Florida, who went on to win it all. You know, the thing that's interesting about these teams, though, aside from Carolina State, notice one thing of all these teams that weren't supposed to get there. When they got to the Final Four, now teams have scouted you. Now teams know you. They usually got knocked off. Usually didn't last so long. Syracuse, sorry. It's not looking good for you. Hopefully, maybe you can turn that a little bit. But it's a little bit tough once you get there and you're no longer a surprise. Other teams look for you. They say, oh yeah, maybe you're not quite as bad as everyone else thought you were. They prepare for you. They get ready and they have, like we talked earlier, they have this whole week to kind of prep and practice and get ready for you. As we do every single week, we have got to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. You know, Villanova couldn't win back-to-back championships. They had a chance, but they couldn't get it done, as we see in this clip from CBS Sports.
So they can hold on to it if they get a rebound.
Nigel Hayes, wow. Rebound, DiVincenzo.
Oh, they double-teamed him.
Wisconsin will go to New York City.
But Villanova had a chance to win back-to-back titles. And that's not that common. We don't see that many teams win it all, return a good collection of those players that won it all, and have a shot to win it again. Do you realize, in 78 seasons of the NCAA tournament, just 8 different teams have managed to win back-to-back titles? It's tough to do. Usually, that first one, you kind of scrape, you kind of surprise, you kind of, I don't want to say luck your way into, but, and then the second one, you return some people, now there's higher expectations. That second one is even tougher. That's what we saw from Villanova this year. It's just a little bit too much. You get an injury, like they did. You have some guys leave, like they did. It's just a little bit tough to win back-to-back titles. So today, our Daily Dose Top 5, we count down the last 5 teams that actually have got it done. The last 5 teams to win back-to-back national championships in college basketball. Men's college basketball. Otherwise, we just have a list of just all Connecticut. Not doing that. All right, number 5 on our list. The 2006, 2007 Florida Gators. Billy Donovan led that group to kind of a surprise title in 2006. If you remember right, it was the UConn Huskies that were favored in 2006. And then they got knocked out by George Mason. Those matchups, we don't match well against George Mason. Florida matched up really well against George Mason. And then they managed to win another title in 2007. You'll remember some of those players. You remember Corey Brewer, Al Horford, Joakim Noah. You might have forgotten guys like Torian Green, Chris Richard, and sharpshooter Lee Humphrey that hit just about every single shot he took. You know, they beat UCLA in 2006, and then they beat Greg Oden and Ohio State in 2007. It's the last time we saw a team win back-to-back titles. Number four on our list, last five teams that have won back-to-back championships, we got to go clear back to 1991 and 1992. The Duke Blue Devils shocked the world when they took down the undefeated UNLV Running Rebels. Remember, Duke was that big underdog when they played in the Final Four. They had met UNLV in the national championship the previous season, and UNLV had put one on them, beat them by 30. But Mike Krzyzewski told that team, the Rebels are beatable, and we're going to beat them. And they believed him. Who knew? Christian Laettner had 28. Bobby Hurley had 12 and 7 assists. Brian Davis had 15. And a freshman named Grant Hill had 11. And Duke knocked off UNLV. You kind of forget that UNLV wasn't the championship game. You know, I give Mike Krzyzewski a ton of credit, not just for beating UNLV. As impressive as that was, UNLV was undefeated. They were rolling. They were like a pro team playing against college teams. But the fact that Duke went on and beat a pretty good Kansas team in the final, that might even be more impressive. And then the next season, all those guys came back just about, and Duke went 34-2 and beat the Michigan Fab Five and won their back-to-back title. Number three on our list, back-to-back champions. This isn't actually fair, because this team did a little more than just go back-to-back. The UCLA Bruins from 1967 to 1973 went back to back to back to back to back to back to back. The Bruins won seven titles in a row. And it wasn't just one guy. It wasn't just Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. It was Mike Warren. It was Mike Lynn. It was Curtis Rowe, Lynn Shackelford, Henry Bibby, Steve Patterson, Sidney Wicks, Larry Farmer, Bill Walton, Jamal and Keith Wilkes, Marcus Johnson. UCLA in this time was the most dominating program in an era in sports history. Absolutely amazing what they did those late 60s, early 70s at UCLA. Number two on our list. You want more proof that UCLA wasn't completely dominant? Yeah, remember that seven titles in a row? It actually came right after them going back to back in 64 and 65. And you can't just say, well, yeah, because John Wooden had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. He just, because he had him. And because he had Bill Walton. If he didn't have those guys, no, because this was before that. Prior to getting Kareem, prior to getting Walton, John Wooden led a team with Walt Hazard, Gail Goodrich, and Keith Erickson to an undefeated season and a championship over Duke in 1964. Then the next year, they went 27-2 and beat Michigan for their second championship in a row. Amazing what UCLA was doing back in the 60s. Yes, we know. Somebody was paying a little bit of money, and I still struggle because John Wooden was such a good guy and doing things the right way, and still have a hard time with that. But can't deny what UCLA did on the floor. Number one, again, we're only going five back. The last team that won back-to-back championships. We go back to 1961. This team actually won three championships. The Cincinnati Bearcats won three in a row. They beat Ohio State and Jerry Lucas in 61 and 62. And then they beat Loyola University from Illinois in 1963. Now, when you hear this, you hear that Cincinnati won those, your first thought is that those titles took place with the incredible Oscar Robertson leading the way, right? Actually, no. Oscar Robertson was gone after 1960. Yes, he kind of got him in a position to do this, but he was already gone. He never got the Bearcats to a championship. They lost twice in the Final Four. They lost once in the Elite Eight. This team was actually led by Carl Bolden, Paul Hoge, Paul Wisenhahn, and Tom Thacker. It is very, very tough to win back-to-back championships in a single elimination tournament. You've got to block out all the distractions. You've got to stay healthy. Got to be a little bit lucky. And you've got to be really, really good to do that. Now, as we do every single week, we have got to get to a staple of our show, the Daily Dose Top 5. You never know what we might be counting down. This week, the NCAA tournament is going to be seeded this weekend. And while I think there are some good teams, I'm pretty sure there probably aren't any great teams in this whole thing. Virginia, Villanova, Xavier, Michigan State, Duke, they all have some very talented players. But they also all have some flaws to their games, and they could be beaten on any given night. Yet, when we look at these teams, their records are all pretty similar. They all have lost anywhere from 2 to 6 or 7 games, right? That's not uncommon. We have actually seen teams win it all with more losses than that. In fact, here is our Daily Dose Top 5, the NCAA champions that have had the most losses when they won it all. Number 5 on our list. Now, we all recognize the point guard on this team, but it was actually the emergence of his supporting cast that helped the Indiana Hoosiers win it all in 1981. They were led by sophomore point guard Isaiah Thomas. The Hoosiers knocked off number 1 seed LSU in the Final Four and then went on to beat Dean Smith's North Carolina Tar Heels in the championship game. Thomas led the Hoosiers in scoring with 16 points a game, but he got help from guys like Randy Whitman, Ray Tolbert, and Landon Turner. The Hoosiers won it all despite losing 9 games during the season, including back-to-back losses, not just once during the season, but twice. Somehow, Bobby Knight screamed his team to a 26-9 record and his second title at the time. That's number 5 on our list. Moving on to number 4. The 1997 Arizona Wildcats, you know, they looked like anything but a title contender coming down the final stretch of the Pac-12 conference season. Yes, they had a ton of talent. They had Mike Bibby. They had Jason Terry, Michael Dickerson, and Miles Simon, but the Wildcats lost 7 of their final 16 games. Somehow, Lute Olson got this group playing excellent in the tournament. No, they weren't dominant. They actually needed overtime to win not just one game, but 2, and they almost needed it for another. They actually won the national championship game in overtime over Kentucky. But hey, in this tournament, you don't get points for being pretty. Arizona got it done despite losing 9 games during the regular season. They finished the year 25-9. Moving on to number 3, NCAA champions with the most losses in a single season. We all remember number 3 because the Villanova Wildcats were a number 8 seed. They won the tournament in 85. They upset Patrick Ewing and the Georgetown Hoyas with a nearly perfect game in the championship. What we kind of forget is that the Wildcats had already played Georgetown twice. They lost by 2 points and they lost by 7 points. So everyone kind of knew they could play the Hoyas. Now, we also might forget that Harold Jensen, Dwayne McLean, Gary McLean, Ed Pinckney, and Harold Presley had gone just 9-7 in the Big East that year. They actually finished with 10 losses on the season. But don't forget, that Big East was stacked. Now, we may see a team this season win it all that has a few losses. But were those losses against good competition? Because Villanova's were in 1985. They come in at number 3 on our list, finishing the year at 25-10. Moving on to number 2. If there is ever an example of a team just getting hot during the tournament and riding that heat to a title, it is the 1983 North Carolina State Wolfpack. They were solid during the season, but they lost 10 games, and not all of them were to top competition. They got swept by an average Maryland team. Wake Forest beat them by 20. But that's the magic of March Madness. When North Carolina State slipped past Pepperdine and UNLV in the first 2 rounds, their confidence started building. They blew out Utah. They snuck past Virginia. And suddenly, North Carolina State was in the Final Four. They beat Georgia, and when they got that miracle dunk from Lorenzo Charles,
He has his three guards in there now as Gannon's in there with Wittenberg and Lowe.
Down to 25 seconds. Dangerous pass.
This is a really interesting strategy by Houston. They're aggressive now, not staying back.
Well, remember they have Akeem in there to block anything that goes inside. Down to 14 seconds.
Oh, almost stolen by Drexler. Boy, is he good at
that. They've got a drive to the basket. It's down to 7 seconds.
You can see the time. Wittenberg, oh, it's a long ways. Oh!
They won it!
A team with double-digit losses won the title. North Carolina State comes in at number 2 with a 26-10 record. They lost 10 times. So which team has lost more games on their way to a championship than any other team in history? I guess it probably stands to reason that it would be a team with a few less weapons than most teams have had, doesn't it? Well, this team basically had one weapon. That's it. But it was a good weapon, and he carried them all the way to a title in 1988. Now, if I give you a team with Scooter Berry, Otis Livingston, Milt Newton, and a sophomore big man named Mark Randall, you could probably predict you're going to lose a few games. But if I throw in one Danny Manning, that changed everything. Because while we might remember the Danny Manning that had bad knees in the NBA, the Kansas Jayhawks version of Danny Manning was incredible. Manning could do it all. He could handle. He could pass. He could shoot. He could rebound. He could drive. He was being compared to Magic Johnson, and with good reason. Manning was averaging 25 points, 9 rebounds, and 2 assists for the season. And in the tournament, he actually bumped up that scoring average to 27 points per game. Danny and the Miracles got revenge for some of the losses they had suffered during the season. They beat Kansas State. They beat Duke, and they beat Oklahoma on their way to the championship. All 3 of those teams had beaten them during the regular season. The Kansas Jayhawks in 1988 come in at number 1 with a 27-11 record. They lost 11 times on their way to a title. Now, the March Madness brackets come out on Sunday, and the tournament will begin next week, and this should be a wide open tournament. No one is unbeatable. Everyone has at least 2 losses, and that isn't uncommon. It's far more the norm than when we do have a heavyweight. Sure, we've had the UCLAs, we've had the Dukes, the North Carolinas, the Kentuckys that were the heavy favorites. But most years, it's just like this. There's 6, 8, maybe 10 teams that could get hot and could win the whole thing. And that is what makes this tournament so great. Now, as we do every single week, we have got to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. Now, on Monday this week, the Villanova Wildcats were crowned NCAA champions as they, of course, beat the Michigan Wolverines. Now, the big story in that game was the play of redshirt sophomore guard Dante DiVincenzo, who just did it all for the Wildcats. I mean, he shot the ball well.
An 11-5 stretch. DiVincenzo breaks their heart.
Early dagger. How about the biggest stage, the brightest lights?
He attacked the basket. He had a couple of very, very memorable blocks. Not bad for a guy coming off the bench. DiVincenzo finished the game with 31 points, 5 rebounds, and 3 assists. And don't forget, when he got in, that was a team that desperately needed a little bit of a boost. They were struggling to get anything going until he came in the game. But here's what you might not realize. It is actually a very rare feat to score at least 30 points in the championship game. Do you realize that since the tournament format changed to 64 teams, there have only been a few players that have scored 30 or more points in the actual title game? How many? Not counting DiVincenzo? Yeah, kind of funny how that works out. So here is our Daily Dose top 5 players that scored 30 or more points in a national championship game. Coming in at number 5. You know, in 1997, the Arizona Wildcats had the reputation for choking in the tournament. You know, it's kind of funny. The more things change, the more they stay the same. Arizona had gone 25-9 in the regular season, and they were named a 4 seed. But I mean, we all just knew they were going to like fall in the first or second round like usual, right? Well, they almost did lose in the second round to the College of Charleston. But then Mike Bibby, Jason Terry, and Michael Dickerson kind of got rolling. They beat Paul Pierce, Rafe LaFrance, and that Kansas team in the Sweet 16. Then they survived Providence in the Elite Eight. And then they beat North Carolina, who had a couple guys by the names of Vince Carter and Antoine Jameson. Yeah, they beat them in the Final Four. They faced Kentucky in the final. Arizona versus Kentucky. Of course, Bibby and Terry went on to solid NBA careers. But in the championship game, it was a guard by the name of Miles Simon that posted 30 points in that final game. And the Arizona Wildcats beat Kentucky and brought the title back to Tucson. Moving on to number four. You know, you might remember our number four entry more for what he did recently, as he was involved in a lawsuit over using collegiate players' likenesses in video games. But back in 1995, he was just a guy trying to get UCLA back to the promised land for the first time in over 20 years. You know, the UCLA Bruins were an explosive team in 95. They had the ability to score some serious points, but in their second round matchup against Missouri, looked like it might have been over until little point guard Tyus Edney went the length of the floor in less than like 5 seconds, and UCLA got the win in advance. The Bruins would eventually face Arkansas in the NCAA championship game, and with everything on the line, it wasn't Tyus Edney. No, it wasn't Toby Bailey. It was Charles O'Bannon that would score 30 points and grab 17 rebounds to help UCLA win the national title. Moving on to number three. Hey, it's no surprise that this guy scored more than 30 points in the national championship game. He averaged almost 30 points for the entire season in 1988. The Kansas Jayhawks were led, of course, by head coach Larry Brown, but Danny Manning averaged nearly 25 points a game, while the next leading scorer on the team, Milt Newton, yeah, he averaged just 11. The Jayhawks would be named a number six seed. Somehow, they rode the talent of Danny Manning all the way to the title game, where they would face a very up-tempo Billy Tubbs Oklahoma Sooner squad. You might remember some players off of that team. Mookie Blaylock, Harvey Grant, Stacey King, Ricky Grace. But it would be Danny Manning that would step up in the title game. He scored 31 points. He grabbed 18 rebounds. And the big man made 5 steals. Danny Manning carried the Jayhawks to the championship in 1988. He comes in at number 3. Moving on to number 2. And this one won't be much of a surprise, as this guy is the leading scorer for an entire tournament in NCAA history. But at the time, his team winning it all was a bit surprising. See, the Michigan Wolverines had gone 30-7 in 1989. They finished third in the Big Ten. But at the end of their season, just prior to the tournament, their head coach, Bill Frieder, he announced he would be leaving Ann Arbor to take the job at Arizona State after the tournament. Of course, Michigan athletic director Bo Schembechler said, "Why wait? I don't want anyone here who isn't a Michigan man anyways." So he booted Frieder out right before the tournament, and he named assistant coach Steve Fisher the interim head coach. Now, there was no doubt that this team was talented, but now they kind of had that common goal. They all wanted to prove Bill Frieder wrong. Rumeil Robinson, Loy Vaught, Sean Higgins, Terry Mills, and of course, Glenn Rice pulled together. They went on an incredible run, capping in the championship game over Seton Hall, where Glenn Rice would score 31 points and grab 11 rebounds. The Michigan Wolverines won an improbable title. So who could come in at number one? Who has scored the most points in a modern NCAA championship game? And understand, we're just going from 85 on. Prior to that, the format was a little different. I realize we had some bigger point records if we go back older, but just in the modern era, who has scored the most points in a championship game? I'll give you a hint. It happened in the same game we just talked about. Now, people might forget about this team, and they definitely forget about this player, but he has the record, at least in games, once the tournament format did change. This was also in 1989. Head coach PJ Carlissimo had led Seton Hall to a 31-7 record. And in the tournament, Andrew Gaze, Ramon Ramos, Daryl Walker, Anthony Avent, And this guy had managed to beat some pretty good teams along the way. First, they beat Indiana, who had Jay Edwards and Joe Hillman. They beat UNLV, who had Stacey Augmon, Moses Scurry, Anderson Hunt, and Greg Anthony. Remember, this was just prior to the arrival of Larry Johnson at UNLV. And then they beat Danny Ferry, Robert Bricky, Phil Henderson, Ala Abdelnaby, and a young guy named Christian Laettner of Duke in the Final Four before Seton Hall faced Michigan in that championship game. They were actually in pretty good shape until the refs called a foul late and Rumeal Robinson hit those free throws and down went Seton Hall. But it was John Morton who scored 35 points for the Pirates in a losing cause. Hey, on Monday night, the game might not have been as close as we had all hoped, but we did see a little history as Dante DiVincenzo put up 31 points and Villanova beat Michigan. It hasn't happened where we have seen someone score at least 30 points nearly as often as we might think it has, but we did see a little bit of history on Monday night. Now, as we do every Friday, we need to get over to our Daily Dose Top 5. Of course, we have seen a very impressive season this year from Duke freshman big man Zion Williamson. When Williamson was coming out of high school, we all knew who he was. If you followed college basketball at all, you knew he was one of the top recruits in the country. We knew he could dunk, no question about that. But there were a few things about Zion that I don't think we knew. We didn't know how much excitement he was going to bring to college basketball, for sure. We didn't know how dominant he would be rebounding the ball. We didn't know how completely explosive he would be, how much better he would shoot the ball than we thought he could. And you know the thing I didn't realize about Zion? I didn't realize the passion that he would bring to the floor every single night. And it's contagious. You can feel it when he is in the game. His team plays harder. Zion Williamson has been so impressive to watch this year. He has averaged 22.5 points this year during the regular season. And for the tournament, yeah, he's actually turned it up a little bit. He's averaging over 28 points per game. No question, Zion Williamson has been one of the more memorable freshmen that we have seen recently. But how does he rank as far as other great freshmen? Because today on the Daily Dose, we are going to be counting down the top five highest scoring freshmen of the past 25, 26, 27 years. I don't want to go back before the tournament was what it really is. And back in the days of UCLA and those kind of things, there just wasn't the depth of competition that we have now. But going back to 1992, I wanted to take a look at the top five highest scoring freshmen that we have had. And how does Zion Williamson right in among them? Remember, he averaged 22.5 this year. Let's take a look at our Daily Dose top five. Coming in at number five is a guy that has gone on to become one of the greatest players in the NBA. Born and raised in the Washington, D.C. area, he was such a different player than we had seen because he had the size of a center. He's around, I don't know, 6'10", 6'11", but he handled the ball. And he was a deadly shooter from the outside. He played just 1 year of college basketball, but during that season, he averaged 25.8 points per game for the Texas Longhorns back in the 2006-2007 season. But when he went into the NBA, he had a number of critics. What is he? What position does he play? He's too skinny. But then you saw Kevin Durant in the NBA, and you just went, wow, I don't know what label I'd put on him other than this. He's completely unstoppable. He's so big. He's so smooth. He can get that shot off whenever he wants. Of course, he was drafted by the Seattle Supersonics, which would eventually become the Oklahoma City Thunder. Then he would join the Golden State Warriors and win a couple of titles there. But Kevin Durant is one of the highest scoring freshmen in NCAA history, but he comes in at number five. Moving up to number four, we actually have a player from this same season, from this year, in 2018-2019, Antoine Davis is a 6'1 guard. He played his freshman season this year for Detroit Mercy. Now, he's originally from Birmingham, Alabama, and he had verbally committed to play basketball for Houston. But you know, family can make you do some strange things. And you might know some of Antoine's family. Here's a question. Do you remember when the Indiana Hoosiers fired Bobby Knight and they installed Mike Davis as their head coach, yeah, Mike is Antoine's father. Of course, Mike ended up getting fired at Indiana. He went to Alabama, Birmingham, where Antoine was born, and he is now the head coach at Detroit Mercy in the Horizon League. This past season, as a freshman, Antoine Davis averaged 26.1 points per game as a freshman, yes, while playing for his dad. He comes in at number four. Coming in at number three, we have one of those players that when he was coming out of college, everyone was kind of saying, hey, this looks like a can't-miss guy. Because when Michael Beasley was the big man on campus at Kansas State, it was a common opinion he would be a dominant NBA player someday. Beasley had been a parade All-American in high school. He actually played his AAU ball with Kevin Durant. His 26.2 points per game and nation-leading 12.4 rebounds per game were the most ever by a Big 12 freshman. Beasley was absolutely dominant at K-State. He would enter the NBA draft after just one season. He was drafted second overall in the 2008 NBA draft, but I mean, his results have been pretty mixed. He shows flashes of being pretty good, but he's not very consistent. He's bounced around already to 7 or 8 teams, and he's played a lot overseas. Michael Beasley is currently playing pro basketball in China. He comes in at number three. On to number two, where we see another very recent player in college basketball. Because just last year, we saw an outstanding season by a freshman at the University of Oklahoma by the name of Trae Young. Trae Young averaged 27.4 points per game last year. And hey, it wasn't just scoring. Trae Young is the first and only player to ever lead the NCAA in both points and assists in a single season because he also averaged nearly 9 assists per game. And he did it as a freshman. Of course, Trae Young ended up being drafted 5th overall by the Dallas Mavericks. He was traded to Atlanta. And as a rookie for the Hawks so far, he's doing pretty good. He's averaging 16 points a game. He's averaging 8 assists per game. Trae Young comes in as the second highest scorer as a college freshman in the past 25 years. So who could be number one on our list? Well, this player averaged 29.3 points per game as a freshman. He is going to be an absolute star, right? Well, no, not really. As a high school senior, our number one entry didn't have very many recruiting offers because he actually had a learning disability. So he settled on the Virginia Military Institute. It took him some time to get enrolled, but when Jason Conley's college basketball career finally started in 2001, 2 full years after his high school graduation in 1999, because of those eligibility problems, he blew up on the national scene. As a freshman, Jason Conley started all 28 games. He averaged 29.3 points, 8 rebounds, and 2.9 steals a game. He shot 46% from the field. That's pretty good. He was 82% from the free throw line. And while he went to VMI, he had some of his best games against top competition. He scored 24 against Kentucky. He scored 25 against Virginia. He scored 38 against Villanova. Jason Conley would eventually transfer to the University of Missouri, but he never could match the stats he put up at VMI. He ended up not being drafted, and after playing some summer ball with the Atlanta Hawks, he has spent the last 12 years playing overseas, and he is currently playing pro ball in Finland. Hey, being a great freshman doesn't guarantee your future success. We have seen a number of impressive first years just kind of dissolve and go away. Will Zion Williamson be able to be that guy that can go from dominating at Duke to dominating at the next level too? Well, we're not going to have to wait very long because he is going to get his opportunity very soon. And I'll be honest, I'm cheering for the kid. I can't wait to see what he's going to do at the next level. Now, as we do every week, we need to get to our Daily Dose Top 5. Yes, we have been talking about March Sadness today as we have no sports to watch and no March Madness to watch. But here's the thing. Even in years that we do have tournaments, great tournaments, some of the best games ever, we have still had some sadness. There is heartbreak as we see careers end. We see mistakes made. Today, our Daily Dose Top 5 is counting down the top 5 memorable sad moments of the NCAA championship game
And I'm telling you right now, I'll bet you're going to remember most all of these. Let's start off at number five. And we go back to 2008. And the Memphis Tigers were finally going to do it. They were finally going to win a title. They had been close back in 85. They had been tough. But now, this was going to happen. Derrick Rose had led the Memphis Tigers to a 9-point lead over the Kansas Jayhawks with just 2 minutes remaining. Hey, just be smart. Take care of the ball. You're going to win this thing. Oh, and one more thing. Be sure to make your free throws. Now, Memphis head coach John Calipari, he had said all year that despite shooting just 59% from the line all season, his team would come through in the clutch when they had to. There was just one problem. They didn't. In the final minute of this game, Memphis made just one of five free throws, and Kansas somehow got the game to overtime. They outlasted Memphis, and Kansas instead won the title. But watching those poor Memphis kids walking to the line with the game on the line and clanking shot after shot after shot, I'm telling you right now, it was one of the saddest moments in March Madness history. They just couldn't make a free throw. And if they had just made even one, they would have been the champs. They couldn't do it. And they come in at number five. We go back to 1989 for our number four entry. And we get to one of the most competitive games in championship history. See, after firing their head coach, Bill Frieder, the Michigan Wolverines had replaced him with Steve Fisher, and they had been finding ways to win under Fisher. In the championship game, they faced the Seton Hall Pirates. Now, both these teams were number three seeds. And in that 89 championship game, we got quite the show. The game was back and forth all night. Seton Hall actually took a 3-point lead with just over a minute to play in overtime. Michigan cut it to one. And with 10 seconds left, Seton Hall's Johnny Morton missed a shot that could have put the Pirates up by three. Instead, Michigan grabs the rebound, and as point guard Ramil Robinson dribbles up the floor trying to find a shot, well, this happened. Here is a clip from CBS.
Michigan's ball. They've got an opportunity here now to win it. They've got to hurry. 5 seconds. Robinson goes in. Foul call with 3 seconds. A foul against Seton Hall with 3 seconds.
Yes, the ref called a bump that just didn't really affect the play at all. There was no advantage gained. Ramil Robinson, who was not a great free throw shooter, knocks down two clutch free throws, and Michigan escapes with the win. Hey, I give Michigan credit for finding a way to win, but it was also kind of sad to see such a great game end on a ref's call that didn't have to be called. Like, let's see if the kids can get a shot up. Let them decide it. The 1989 National Championship game comes in on our list at number four. We move up to number three. And we have proof that beauty is in the eye of the beholder, because there is a sect of college basketball fans that will say, hey, this was a wonderful win for our team. But I'm telling you right now, most of the rest of the planet was cheering for it to go the other way. Back in 2010, the Duke Blue Devils were again one of the top teams, so it was no surprise when they went to the championship game. What was a surprise was when they faced the Cinderella team, the Butler Bulldogs, who did not back down all night. Duke led by just a point at halftime, and the game would come down to the final buzzer. With just over 3 seconds left, Duke up one. Duke big man Brian Zubek was fouled. He made the first shot, made it a 2-point game. Then he intentionally missed the second shot because Butler didn't have any timeouts left. Butler grabs the rebound, and Gordon Hayward rushes up the court and launches a shot from half court. If it goes in, Butler is going to win this game. Here is a clip of that sad moment from CBS.
So they would hope that Zubek makes this.
Not going to try. It's Hayward pulling it down. Getting around Zubek. At midcourt, launches the shot. Oh, it almost went in! Almost went in, and Duke is the king of the dance, 2010.
Can you imagine if it had gone in? Butler, the team that plays its home games in the arena where Hoosiers filmed their championship game, Butler would have been the national champions. Hey, that shot almost went in. Now, I know Duke fans are like, oh, that's a great win. Everyone else was like, oh, can you imagine if Butler had pulled off the ultimate upset? It was a moment of sadness when Hayward's shot rolled off the front of that rim. And Butler's shot not going in comes in at number three. We move on to number two. And for number two, we go back to 1982, where the North Carolina Tar Heels were facing the Georgetown Hoyas in one of the classic championship games of all time. Patrick Ewing and Eric Sleepy Floyd had led Georgetown to a one-point lead with just over 15 seconds to play when a freshman by the name of Michael Jordan knocks down a shot from the wing and gives North Carolina the lead. But there was still time to play. Georgetown point guard Fred Brown pushes the ball up the floor. He's looking to get the ball into a scoring position, and he picks up his dribble and starts to make a pass. But North Carolina forward James Worthy jumps up into the passing lane to take that angle away. So Brown pulls the ball back down. He's looking for an open teammate. He's kind of struggling, like you can tell. He's kind of getting nervous. And then he sees something out of the corner of his eye next to him. So he passes the ball back out toward half court. The only problem was it wasn't to a teammate. It was to Worthy, who had just stayed up there. Surprised, Worthy grabs the ball and takes off with it. And the North Carolina Tar Heels beat the Georgetown Hoyas. And hey, you had to feel bad for Fred Brown. It was just, he saw something there. He assumed it was a teammate. It was just a mistake in a really, really tight moment. It was no doubt a really, really sad moment in NCAA history. But here's some good news. On the positive side, the Hoyas and Fred Brown, they would return the next year to the title game and they would win it. So good news for Fred Brown. It didn't end there, but it definitely was a sad moment in the NCAA championship game, and it comes in at number two. So we move on to the number one memorable sad moment in the NCAA championship game, and we go back to 1993, where the North Carolina Tar Heels were once again in the championship game. But this time, they would be facing the young, brash, cocky, upstart Fab Five from the University of Michigan. Now remember, the young Wolverines had gone to the title game the previous year, but then they got manhandled by the more mature Duke Blue Devils. So here, in 93, was their chance at redemption. But it was the Tar Heels that were actually coming up with all the big plays. Donald Williams had 25 points. Eric Montrose had 16 points. Down the stretch, it was North Carolina that led by three when Chris Webber scored a putback to cut the lead to just one with 37 seconds left. With 20 seconds left, Michigan fouled Carolina guard Pat Sullivan. He makes the first shot to make the lead two. Then he misses the second shot, which Chris Webber rebounded. And when he gets the rebound, he immediately travels. Okay, the refs swallow their whistles. Quite a change from back in 89, if you'll remember. And Webber dribbles the ball into the front court. But there were a few problems when he got there. First, Michigan had used their final timeout. They were out of timeouts. Second, no one from Michigan wanted the basketball. You could see all the players, all the guys that now talk and now say things. They might be on, I don't know, ESPN. They were all hiding in the corners. They wanted nothing to do with that basketball. They didn't want anything to do with that big moment. So Webber is out there by himself. Third, a few genius players from the Michigan bench are signaling for Chris Webber to call a timeout. You can hear it yourself. Here's a clip from CBS.
Long, a two to tie. Michigan will have to bring it.
Oh, he walked. He walked and the referee missed it.
Webber brings it into the front court. They have no timeouts remaining.
Oh, he causes too many timeouts. That's a technical foul.
He called a timeout. Michigan doesn't have any.
He got by with a walk, and Jimmy calls a technical. He calls a timeout. He doesn't realize that's Michigan's too many, and so it'll be a technical foul. North Carolina shooting and the ball.
Yes, Chris Webber calling timeout with no timeouts remaining, and the North Carolina Tar Heels upsetting those Michigan Wolverines comes in at the top of our list of saddest March Madness moments. Hey, you might be wondering, why in the world did you make the theme of our show this week March Sadness? Aren't we all sad enough right now? Well, one, we did try to keep it a little bit light. But the thing I want to point out, at the time these things happened, they were horrible. They were terrible. No one's ever going to recover from this. Now, they're just another memory for March Madness. This year, 2020, this tops the list for me as far as saddest moments. But just remember, we will move on. We will get back to having fun. We will get back to enjoying sports once again, It will be coming. You can tell we do move on from moments like this. Hey, next week on The Dose, we will get back to our regular format and we will be recapping all of the March Madness action that we have missed. Plus, the NFL has a lot going on these days and those NBA playoffs, they are coming quickly. So be sure you stop by The Daily Dose and be sure you tell a friend to do the same. Hey, I want to thank each and every one of you for listening to The Daily Dose every week. Thank you for the emails. Thank you for the texts. Thank you for the tweets. Thank you for going over to DailyDoseSports.com and checking out the new things going up there every week. But more than anything, thank you for sharing the show, for sharing the videos, for sharing the articles with someone that you know. Absolutely love it when you do that. Have to say thank you to GSP. Could not do any of this without you. I will see you all next Wednesday. Have a great week, everybody.
Take very short breaths.